This Friday evening into Saturday is a Celtic holiday, the holiday of Beltane. The days on the Celtic calendar, as the days on the Jewish calendar, begin at sunset the day before. And Beltane is one of the four quarter days. So if you imagine the year as a circle, it has an upper light half, you might say a yang half, and a lower dark half, you might say a yin half. Beltane is the crossing point where it crosses from the dark semicircle into the light semicircle, the crossing from darkness into light. And so it's associated with May Day. That actually was an ancient medieval German holiday, Walpurgisnacht, which occurred the night before May Day. So that would be Friday night. And in the ancient literature, in fact, even to this day, sometimes in Ireland, they will say Beltane, and then the corresponding time, Samhain, when it crosses from light to dark in November. These 2 days are days when the veil between the worlds is thin. And they're talking about the ordinary factual human world and the world of the fairies, the wee people, you know, who would, especially on Beltane and Samhain, they would cross into our world and cause all kinds of mischief. And the later story of leprechauns comes from these legends. And it's a fascinating image because, of course, as the Upanishads had figured out 3 millennia ago, all gods, all demons, all heavens, all hells, all worlds are representations of mind, are representations of some aspect of the greater psyche. And so I was intrigued by this idea of the inner wildness, the part of us that is wild, untamed, mischievous, you know. And it stands in contrast, you might say, to the part of us that is more rational, organized, logical, predictable, dependable, reliable, these sorts of things. And those are wonderful skills, you know, those very stabilizing skills. They're absolutely wonderful. They're the type of skills that if you don't learn them in childhood, it's hard to learn them, you know, that sort of thing. But it's not the whole of who we are. And our most vital places have a more wild, untamed quality to them. Now, this is a society where so many people live up in their heads. And it's a very verbally driven society, a very cognitive society. Tremendous amount of value is placed on being rational, organized, logical, predictable, this sort of thing. And while that has, it certainly, undeniably has its advantages, a life that is only that can be sterile. It can lack the spark. And to some extent, you could say, you know, the template for our wild side is simply our emotions. You know, I don't get to choose what I feel. I get to choose how I respond to it. I certainly get to choose whether I speak it or act on it, you know, how it might come spilling out of me. But there's something independent, certainly with individual emotions and certainly with moods, you know. There's some other place that ego is then responding to, you know. And if I have a kind of emotional agility, I can even reframe. And reframing is a very sophisticated psychological move. That's when confronted with one situation and one emotion comes up, but then I'm able to shift perspective, look at it another way, and that allows me to access another emotion, usually a much easier to deal with emotion. But it takes a certain amount of agility to do that, a certain letting go of not holding on. Trauma, of course, is what causes people to hold on. People who have been through trauma, you know, the classic responses in fear responses are flight, fight, or freeze. And a lot of the freeze happens in the body, and it's held in the body. And so sometimes with trauma, when it hits the emotions, some people are just completely emotionless. You know, they can, you know, the spigot of emotions is just turned off. And it's a tremendous struggle even for them to access the basic emotions. For other people, the spigot of emotion is stuck on. And so it's just this constant gush of emotions that they can't control. A lot of healing is about getting in touch with developing a comfort, you might say, with the watery aspect of life. The flowing aspect of life. In Chinese medicine, when they talked about the kidneys, the kidney bladder system is the system that is designed to help us deal with the qi of water. And when the kidney bladder system is not in balance, we feel fear. And so fear is very much associated with that fear is a very natural reaction to the flow if we're not ready for the flow. When our kidneys and our kidney system is healthy, then we have the virtue of adaptability, the ability to go with the flow. So I've always liked the idea that the opposite of fear is adaptability. And that's what allows us the agility, among other things, to emotionally reframe. And so certainly there are parts of us that are not under our control, certainly where our dreams come from, you know, much of our bodily energies, our sexuality, you know, cycles of grief, cycles of anger, cycles of rage. And it's important for ego to have the adaptability, you know, to develop not only the yang strengths of organization and predictability and control and all that, but also the yin strengths of being able to, as it were, ride those waves and respond to them. I think there's a way that the more we push back against it, I don't want to feel that, I don't want to experience that, we give it energy and it has more of a wild edge to it. The more we can be in sync with it, it has more a seasonal, kind of a tidal rhythm of back and forth. There's a gentler quality to it in a way by not resisting it. And it's funny, there is an aspect of the sacred that we apprehend in the yang, that we apprehend in structure and stability and all that. And, you know, in many ways, the Christian idea of God, in many ways embodies that very structured, predictable sort of aspect of the sacred. And there's an aspect of the sacred that derives from the wild and uncontrollable side. I think of the Hindu goddess Kali, for example, or some of the African gods. And so there are emotions and passions and energies of the body that we don't control. But perhaps more significantly, we are not in control of healing. We're not in control of the arc of our growth. I think we've all had experiences, you know, certainly if I've had experiences when I was younger, when I had a plan in my head and I thought my life is going to look like this, you know, and then, you know, of course, it's laughable. You look back now, you know, my life looks nothing like that plan that I had in my head. You know, the head is so arrogant. The head thinks that it knows exactly what's going to go on. The head is often the last to know about growth. And so growth can come in many ways. Growth can be dramatic or it can be subtle. And so I'm going to share in a moment a visual image, a very striking visual image from the history of art. It's a painting by Caravaggio called The Call of St. Matthew. And before I share this, I just want to frame it a little bit, what's going on in this picture. It's a biblical event, and in fact, the biblical narrative is astonishingly minimalist. You know, Jesus is walking into a town one day, he sees the tax collector Matthew at his post, he says, Matthew, come follow me, be my follower. Matthew follows him. That's all we get. That's the biblical text. What we know in that time, what we know historically, tax collectors in the Roman Empire, what the Roman Empire would do basically is they, for each geographic region, they would auction off the job as tax collector. And so someone would pay money to be the tax collector. And then they pay Rome, and then Rome would go off. They'd have their tax revenue. You know, they'd be done. And then the tax collector basically was allowed to do whatever means he wanted to charge however much tax he could get away with, you know. And he had the backing of the Roman military. So it was an incredibly exploitative system, you know. I mean, these people made IRS bureaucrats look like saints. And Matthew was a Jew, and he was collecting taxes from Jews. And so he was really regarded as a traitor to his own people. And so this would have been a man who had a certain amount of political privilege, a certain amount of wealth, but also was reviled by his own people and had to face those people every single day. And so you can imagine the kind of thick skin that would be required to have that position. So this is the portrait of Matthew that I'm trying to create. And then he has his encounter with Jesus. And so this is what it looked like to Mr. Caravaggio. And I love this photo for this painting for so many reasons. You know, we have St. Peter here. He's arguing with this guy. I love this guy here. He's just looking kind of suspicious, like, you know, I don't know about this. This growth stuff. I don't know. These two guys, I love them over on the side here. They have their head down. They can tell there's something big. There's growth there. And it's like, I don't want to see it. I'm going to keep on counting coins. It's too big. I'm not even going to look at it, you know. And I know I've been there so many times. Not even going to look at it, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's Matthew in the middle. And Jesus is way over here. He's in the shadows and he's making some vague gesture with his arms. But his eyes are nailing Matthew. And I don't know how well you can see in this Matthew's eyes. But it's a moment of utter innocence. It's as if all the hardness, all the thick skin has instantly fallen away. Everything that he was instantly fell away. He doesn't have any idea what's next, but he knows that that's the direction he's going to go. Now, because we know the story, we know that Matthew eventually became one of the 12 apostles. He eventually wrote the first book of the New Testament. He could have seen nothing, none of that at this moment. All he knew was he had lost everything and was starting on something new. Sometimes growth is like that. Sometimes growth is dramatic. sometimes growth is much more subtle. I think there's ways that life gives us hints all the time about the ways we should be growing. And if I'm obeying those hints, then I can have this more subtle kind of introduction to growth. If I'm ignoring one hint after another, that's when I have the cataclysmic growth. That's when I have the shattering experience, you know, because I wasn't able to open to it slowly. I'm also going to read a poem, but let me, in case you want to study it on your own, here is the image from St. Caravaggio's image. I'm a big fan of Caravaggio's paintings. I'm also going to share a poem by David White along these lines. So I'll link the poem in the chat there. The title is Revelation Must Be Terrible. Revelation must be terrible with no time left to say goodbye. Imagine that moment staring at the still water with only a brief tremor of your body to say you are leaving everything and everyone you know behind. Being far from home is hard, but you know, at least we are exiled together. When your eyes are open to the world, you are on your own for the first time. Now, no one is even interested in saving you. And the world steps in to test the calm fluidity of your body from moment to moment, as if it believed you could join its vibrant dance of fire and calmness and final stillness. As if you were meant to be exactly where you are, as if like the dark branch of a desert river, you could flow on without a speck of guilt, and everything everywhere would still be just as it should be. As if the world mattered, as if your place in the world mattered, and the world could neither speak nor hear the fullness of its own bitter and beautiful cry without the deep well of your body resonating the echo. Knowing that it takes only that one terrible word to make the circle complete, revelation must be terrible, knowing you can never hide your voice again. And again, a very powerful image of you might say, the unsettling nature of the sacred, the nature of growth as something that entirely unsettles us. And it's funny, the nature of the teaching, you know, we can be open to lessons, we can be attentive, but it's just the nature of the teaching. Sometimes the teaching is, by its very nature, gentle, gradual, subtle. Sometimes the nature of the teaching is shocking, you know. And again, we don't get to say. It's very funny, the Buddhist idea of impermanence. When we think of impermanence, you know, we often think of external objects, external relationships, you know, governments or systems or things like that. It's also true that the ideas and beliefs that we cherish about ourselves are impermanent. The way I have of looking at myself, the way I have of being comfortable with myself, those two are impermanent. You know, and that's a deeper kind of impermanence. So at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. I guess I should explain the first quote a little bit. I talked about the Bagua about a month ago. The Bagua are the trigrams from the I Ching, and Confucius wrote commentaries on these. The first Bagua, the first Gua, is thunder, which is called the arousing. Thunder has a quality of shocking, coming up from the earth. It's very interesting. Most cultures on earth believe thunder comes from the sky. The Chinese believe that thunder comes from the earth. And so it's this ungrounding, shocking quality. And Confucius simply said, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. God comes forth in that ungrounding, shocking experience. Emerson said, "Only to the degree that people are unsettled is there any hope for them." I love that. Van Gogh said, "Normality is a paved road. It's comfortable to walk, but no flowers grow." Walter Otto said, "He who begets something which is alive must dive down into the primal depths in which the forces of life dwell. When he rises to the surface, there is a gleam of madness in his eyes, because in those depths, death lives cheek by jowl with life. The primal mystery is itself mad, the matrix of duality and the unity of disunity." Solzhenitsyn said quite simply, "We do not err because the truth is difficult to see. It is visible at a glance. We err because this is more comfortable." Jack Kerouac said, "The only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, 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 like a fabulous yellow Roman candle exploding like spiders across the sky. In the middle, you see the blue center light pop, and everyone goes, aw." Kerouac was very much one of those people. James Hillman said, "Anytime you're going to grow, you're going to lose something. You're losing what you're hanging on to keep safe. You're losing habits that you're comfortable with. You're losing familiarity." Edward Abbey said, "Why this cult of wilderness? Because we like the taste of freedom, because we like the smell of danger." Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The ultimate measure of where a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at challenge and controversy." So almost the idea that the real self, our real self, comes out when there's a bit of chaos, you know. Derrida said, "Monsters cannot be announced. One cannot say, here are our monsters, without immediately turning the monsters into pets." And it's very fascinating. Something about the mind, something about the ability to name things. When we actually can name it and control it, there's a way that it's lost its power, or that we've lost touch with the more powerful aspect of it. Wendell Berry says, "In human culture lies the preservation of wildness." I love this Mary Oliver quote. I know I've used it before. "This is the first wildest and wildest thing I know, that the soul exists and it is built entirely out of attention." Tom Hennen said, "Help me to be in the world for no purpose at all, except for the joy of sunlight and rain. Keep me close to the edge where everything wild begins." Tara Brock says, "If our hearts are ready for anything, we are free to be ourselves. There's room for the wildness of our animal selves, for intimacy and understanding, creativity and productivity. There's room for spirit, for the light of awareness to suffuse our moments. The Tibetans describe this confidence to be who we are as the lion's roar." And certainly a person who can be fully in command of the yang virtues of being dependable, predictable, reliable, but also fully in touch with their wildness, that is something very powerful. Alexis Delp said, "Love makes the wildest spirits tame and the tamest spirits wild." Nikita Gill said, "Some days I am more wolf than woman, and I'm learning how to stop apologizing for my wild." Victoria Erickson said, "Half of me is filled with bursting words, and half of me is painfully shy. I crave solitude, yet also I crave people. I want to pour life and love into everything and also nurture my self-care and go gently. I want to live with the rush of the primal intuitive decisions, yet also wish to sit and contemplate. This is the measure of life, that we all carry multitudes, and so must sit with the shifts. We are complicated creatures, and ultimately the balance comes from this understanding. Be water, flowing, flexible, soft, subtly powerful and open, wild and serene, able to accept all changes, yet still led by the pull of steady ties. Tides, it is enough. Shikoba said, the wild winds called to her soul, and through the ground she felt the thundering hooves of freedom. Rita Clint says, sometimes I think I live in a gap between two worlds. One world that I have to wake up to, be an adherent of the rules, and live in a place that is dictated by others, a place that I sometimes feel the fear of aging and dying before I figured out what it is I'm here to do. The other world is sweet, fresh, and misty, inviting adventure into the unknown, melding ancient wisdom with new discovery, the sunlight turning into moonlight, and the spell of eternal life is never broken. Perhaps in that gap I should repair the forgotten bridge from one side to the other, but truth be told, I don't want to. I don't want to because I don't have the energy to fix what is broken within. I am a wild, wandering nomad. I belong to everywhere and nowhere at the same time, and in that gap between the worlds, I am free. And finally, Adrienne N. says, my wild spirit is my deepest truth, my greatest experience, and my highest love. It cannot be contained. It defies rules and explanations and logic. I embrace my untamed spirit and unleash her into the world that is meant to be filled with joy and love and laughter. I feel the wind in my hair, lift my gaze to the sky, raise my arms, and invite the thunder. I remember how great it feels to be exposed and wildly alive.